okay, well, this is not prepped at all, so this will be fun. Me going off the dome about a very new thing to me. Have you heard of functional? Are we recording?
Well, I mean, we could be, but we haven't even said
hello
to everybody.
Oh, right. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, see, I'm still new to this world. Go ahead, Doug. Take it away.
I am Doug Friedman.
I am Kenzie Janest.
And this is Your Mental Breakdown,
the podcast.
Kenzie has something to say.
No, I have a question to ask.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Who's there?
Oh my God. I'm not that funny. Like, I don't come in hot with jokes, Doug.
No, you came in hot with like, I got some psychology, factual, clinical things.
Yeah, because
I want to talk about cooking dog food.
And yeah, guess what? You've like been in this field for a long time. I'm still relatively fresh. Can we talk theory, please? Because I nerd out on it.
Would you like some tea?
Nope. I've already had my matcha latte and I'm fired up. I'm ready to go.
Bring it on.
So, functional analytic psychotherapy. 101. Here we are, class.
Bring it on.
No, it really is. So it says here, I just looked it up so I could give the formal definition, right? It's a contemporary contextual behavioral therapy grounded in empirically supported principles, blah, 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 in an intense, caring, and relational therapeutic relationship. So I just started reading more about it. I asked you about it because I think that you naturally do this, but you don't really pay attention to theory and like being very technical and clinical when you're in the work, right? In the room, whereas I do, and I'm still trying to quiet that part of me and make it more organic, right? I love contextual behavioral therapy because it's saying that there's like a function for every behavior, and behavior includes emotions, thoughts, and overt behaviors. And they've all been learned and they've all been shaped by development, and all behavior is learned and they all serve a purpose or a function. Like you always talk about like, what's the function of that? Or this is a function of that. And it's like, I see it as combining behavioral science with psychodynamic therapy or like a relational interpersonal process in therapy.
Right.
To me, I'm like, here it is. Like, this is Heaven's Gate, because I hate the distinction between the two. Like, why does it have to be pure hard behavior science and then pure psychodynamic, the past is everything and childhood and like, right? And this like combines the two so beautifully, and you get to use yourself in the room, which you do very naturally. I think I do, and I'm trying to make it more natural. And it just is very relational. It takes into consideration the therapist's feelings in the room and what comes up for them and how those, they call them clinically relevant behaviors that pop up within the client and the therapist.
Even what we were talking about a week or two ago about how I took a client out of their emotional experience by trying to give the client an objective view of something with a story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it took him out of his experience. And then later, I think the following week, I came back with a real apology. That's what you're talking about. There's that behavioral aspect that I'm doing in the room as the therapist, and they can see that and feed off of that.
Right. And you're like, how did I evoke a response from them? Like, what did I do to get them to respond in a certain way? And what happened the second before they responded that way? You know, like, what was going on and what's the function of that?
Right.
Ooh, it's so juicy. It's so interesting to me.
And to me, a lot of what you're talking about is based on the relationship with the client and the therapist.
Yeah.
That's tantamount to anything. And that's Carl Rogers. That's relational therapy.
Carl Rogers, totally. They do mention Rogerian humanistic therapy in the beginning of this book, because obviously all theories are very similar. I just love it. I love not being a stoic brick wall of a therapist and using yourself in the room, because therapy is the dress rehearsal for life, right?
Right.
Like, it's kind of like we get to see what's going on in the room and be like, hey, I wonder if this is occurring anywhere outside of the room too with other people. You know, do any of these behaviors, thoughts, feelings, emotions come up with other people, or does it come up with me in the room here? And how can we kind of experiment? It's very experiential. Like, how can we try something different here now?
How do we carve that pathway in your brain and allow you to give yourself permission to do that here in this relationship? And what is it about this relationship that allows you to do that?
Yes. When I feel safe, when I feel validated, when I feel trusted. Yeah. Right. And it's like, oh, okay, well, how do I get that in my other relationships then, if that's what I need?
And let me actually say this loud and clear for all listeners. A lot of times when you're in the room with somebody and it doesn't feel great, or something isn't working, rather than think you're the problem, just realize this relationship might not be the best relationship for us to do therapy and for us to heal from both sides of the couch, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of therapists will think that they need to retain a client.
Yeah.
And a lot of clients will think, oh, yeah, I tried therapy and it didn't work for me.
Right. They overgeneralize and extrapolate just from that one anecdotal experience of like that one therapist, that first session or two that didn't feel good.
For therapists and clients alike, recognize that if it isn't working and isn't a good fit, it might just be because it isn't a good fit.
Yeah, because you can't be everybody's cup of tea. You could be the juiciest, ripest peach in the garden, and there's still going to be somebody who doesn't like peaches, right?
Wow.
I know. It's so deep.
Yeah.
So profound. I obviously didn't come up with it. I just really like that quote. As a therapist, I'm thinking, I've heard you need to be able to help a variety of clients, like all of them. You should know all of the DSM and be able to treat everything. No, and it's like, how? I'm one person with my worldview and my experience. And like, there's not enough time in the world, I think, for me to master every single disorder and every type of theory and treatment modality.
Here's a story about that. When I was young, I remember going into my dad's office. He was a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And there were all these law books behind him, you know, on the shelf. And I'm talking to him about, you know, what I'm going to do after high school. I'm like, I don't know. I'm going to be a rock star.
Yeah,
like,
of course. I don't know, whatever, with your dreads. Yeah.
And that's exactly. And he said, what about being a lawyer? I was like, I can't be a lawyer, Dad. I don't know all the laws. I thought being a lawyer meant you had to know every single law.
Yep, all of it.
And he looked at me and went, what? And I wasn't like a young kid. I was like a late high schooler, right?
Yeah.
Maybe even college. And he just goes, why do you think I have all these books behind me? And so I can look up laws. I learned the language, the law, in order to understand what these laws mean and how to read these laws and how to interpret them for other people.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, we're just like that. We're therapists that learn this language, but what we specialize in, whether it's criminal law, real estate law, marriage and family law,
forensics, divorce.
Exactly.
So
y'all listen to this session. We will be back with you if you have any questions for us at any time about actual therapy. Email us at info@yourmentalbreakdown.com. Follow us. Heard that too. Follow us on social media at Your Mental Breakdown at I don't know. I'm losing it.
Oh, no.
Wherever we
are. YourMentalBreakdown.com.
Just find Your Mental Breakdown.
Just Google it. Just bing it.
All right. We're out of here.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
I did try to put some of the things we've been working on into practice. So yesterday evening, I told my coworker, I just said, look, I'm really swamped. You know, I'm going to be fixing this report up until the last second today to have it ready. So can you please take control of the meeting in the sense like be the host and share the documents? There's no reason I have to do it, but I just always do it, right? Because I'm like, if I don't do it, it's not going to be right. So I was like, can you please just, you know, take it from me? And at first she was like, what? Really? Why? Like, what? She was all confused. And then she was like, started getting all nervous and stuff, removing myself from being the person who has to do it. That's my goal.
Right.
My new goal, if it's a thing that any human with two hands and two arms and a brain can do, it doesn't need to be me. So I'm trying to start seeing those things and seeing how I can give them to others to take responsibility for. It might just be down to exhaustion, but I did it like three times today.
Maybe exhaustion is what helped loosen your grip on the filter that you normally have. To say it's just exhaustion? No, that was, you did that. You said that. You offloaded
that. Yes, I did make a conscious effort to do it for sure.
Yeah.
Actually, it felt very nice. It felt very nice. Then it was all on her. Like the part that I wasn't handling was now on her shoulders. It was okay because I wasn't controlling the, you know, the slides and the things. So it was, I don't know, it was nice. It was good.
Was it okay for you to not be the essential piece?
It really was. For this, it really was. This piece is no reflection of me or
coworker.
What she's showing on the screen was me. That was my work completed. But actually controlling the slides that come up and which document is shared, that's, I don't know. There wasn't an element of fear, like, oh my God, if she messes this up, I'm going to look bad, if that makes sense. I'm getting there. I'm getting there, Doug, slowly.
It's sort of like you're doing something in a low stakes way, right? Like it wasn't a direct reflection of me, so it was okay. What I hold almost any time you talk about this is when I'm going to be judged based on someone else, the consequences are severe and traumatic, so I don't like that. So I will do it because I will do it better than all of them. I almost went into it myself with over-enunciating and being that, you know, being that voice, like, I will do it because I will do it better than they will do it. If it's in a low stakes way, awesome. Then that's what it takes. It's like you said a while ago when you're like, this might just be a fluke. I'm like, there's no such thing as a fluke.
No. Nope.
It means you're still creating a new neural pathway or taking that pathway when you haven't before. So it's not a reflection on you. You won't feel the judgment, but you will go through the motions of offloading stuff, not being essential. And that nod that you had, like, was that a, I mean, you like that.
It's not that I ever want to be the center of attention or anything, but I never want to not be important or needed, not just at work, you know, I think in life in general.
There's a difference between being the essential piece without whom the thing falls apart or being a valued piece.
That's healthy. I like that.
Yeah. What's the difference?
Well, being valued is, I mean, how I'm treated, really. Like I've told you, by my main boss, he treats me very well and he always makes me feel very valued. Essential to me is like, if this isn't here, everything's broken. Whereas value just means like, I see you, I see what you're doing, and I see what you're contributing.
That's such a great distinction to hear you make that.
That's how I want to look at it. But until you broke it down and then you made me, you know, explain the difference, I would have never even made that distinction between valued and essential. It actually resonated with me, right? It's like the punching bag versus the screaming in the pillow. It's those little things that actually help me go, you know, start to see a path where before I either didn't see it or I was too scared, right, to see it. And I would just be like, no, I don't want to think about that. But you're giving me new ways to think about that same thing, but in a different context.
And what's really cool is you are thinking about it in these different ways, different for you, and it's making sense to you, and you're putting it into practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why it's not a fluke. That's why it doesn't matter if it's low stakes. It's still, wow, look, I experimented with offloading things and not being the one, you know, it's all on me. I think you have been driven a lot by the idea that I have to be essential.
Yes.
Or else I am not valued.
When I was younger, I did everything I could to fade into the background so I never got noticed, right? Because that meant I didn't get in trouble and I could like fly under the radar. So the contrast, now I'm wondering if there's any kind of correlation. Like I was like, I'm never going to be, you know, that little mouse in the corner who never gets heard and never gets, you know, attention or care or love, but they also don't get beaten and disciplined or whatever as much as, let's say, my younger sister, who was just constantly in trouble for something.
Or your brother, who became one of them.
Or that.
Right? And I mean, two different sides.
Yep.
It's kind of the, not necessarily extremes, but they're different ends of the spectrum. You have thrived on being essential along the same lines of the theme of being essential, of being seen. I'm either not seen, I'm the mouse in the background, or I need to stand out. I need to get A's. We don't get C's in this house. We get A's. We don't get the honorable mention. We don't get the honorable mention at the science fair. We need the blue ribbon. And it became less about so I don't get beaten and more about so I am seen.
Yeah, and I'm thinking to sort of, you know, my progression and how I got to be who I am. And I wonder if when I made that separation and decided to leave the cult, I remember having to tell myself that, you know, I was on my own and I had to figure shit out, right? Nobody, no help, no nothing, just straight up on my own. And I wonder if that somehow became like me setting rules almost for how other people were going to behave towards me. That's sort of how I feel. And I'm working on softening some of those edges. But I guess what I want to kind of explore here is how I, you know, how I got to be this way.
There's two big points I hear in this. One is, yes, I'm going to stand out and be excellent and be exceeds expectations in everything that I do so that I am seen, because I've been in the shadows for so long and now I want to be seen. And I'm also going to protect myself from being, you know, I'm air quoting beaten, by telling people how to act, by controlling, we've used that word a lot, the situation. That's why my annual review, I'm going to write a 12-page paper on what I need to improve. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it makes sense. I either do it really well or I just don't do it at all. So I guess I just need to find places where I can let that relax a bit. Start to let that be okay. You know, where the C's are okay. I'm not saying I've found those places, but I am like actively looking for those places, especially at work and here at home, trying to get, you know, a handle on allowing, or I mean, I should probably say allowing my kids to do their chores and help keep the house clean. Because historically, I've just been so impatient with the mess that I just do it all myself. And then when it's time for chores, I'm like, you can re-scrub the bathroom.
It's going to be weird, but a lot of what you're talking about, not right now, but eventually, will allow you to relax and do less, have more energy. Right now and previously, it doesn't, because what happens in your head, the anxiety, what you would call the OCD, what we could say is a trauma response. We're talking about controlling a situation, controlling the environment, making sure I'm okay, everyone's okay. What we're talking about is controlling your environment, controlling how people act towards you, how people think of you. I mean, controlling your annual review by telling them where you can improve. That's
just to be clear, we were supposed to do
I know.
I just went,
of course.
You know.
Look, I'm going to make fun of you a little bit.
Okay? I know, you
but I'm
do.
Making fun of this kind of personality here. It's you could walk onto an airplane going to London, knock on the, you know, knock on the cockpit door and say, excuse me, Captain, I realize that there's going to be some turbulence going over the East Coast, so you might want to take a northwest route before you head directly east, and probably want to be between 35,000 and 40,000 feet over this stretch here. Here, I've mapped it out for you. Here you go. What do you think of that?
That would be very silly, because I don't know my ass from my elbow when it comes to navigation. But that is getting involved or trying to assert yourself in a situation where you have absolutely no reason to be doing that. You have no experience flying a plane, right?
Let's say you did. Let's say you knew that stuff to be factually true.
Then I might do that. I'm just being honest. If I was a pilot and I was just taking a flight, someone else was flying, I mean, I'm not going to put it past me. If nothing else, I would check in and just be like, hey, did you saw that weather update? Okay. You know, something that would make me feel, yes, I probably would. Just in case they weren't aware or they didn't know the best route to go, I was just going to make sure that they had all the information. I don't know what the word would be. Control. Probably that. Mm-hmm. Just the thought, you know, just the idea that I have information that is useful. I don't know if this person knows it or not, but by telling them, I have essentially, I guess, controlled the situation as much as I can. So
yeah. What would that do for you?
Probably make me relax a bit more. Somehow it would probably give me more calm. You know, something bad is about to happen to your kid, or you see something coming. I like to try and, I'm going to say control, but really it's like fix everything before it happens.
Yeah. And I hear, especially the kid example, when you see something's about to happen, you want to protect them. You don't want them to be hurt. You don't want them to suffer. The reality is sometimes they need to learn, and they need to learn by virtue of falling down.
Yeah. It's hard for me.
Yeah. And we want to protect them.
Yeah. It's a difficult concept for me. Really, really difficult with my children, but also a difficult concept for me with colleagues, even work colleagues. I see what they're about to do, and I'm like, oh, that's so not what you should be doing. In my experience, though, when people fuck stuff up, I get it. This is how my mind works.
And we're talking about fixing something before it happens, or after it happens, or trying to be prepared, or trying to have more control, or trying to reduce suffering. Most of these things are noble in their intention. What it also does, what I see it doing to you, is it creates a lot more stress, pressure, anxiety, work, energy.
It's hard. It's hard for me with my kids on that side, but I see the importance of allowing them to make mistakes, making bad decisions, or making a decision and allowing them to experience, like we discussed, the consequences of that. I understand that that's important for their growth and all that. It's really just about getting me to sit the fuck down. Like, just don't look out. Don't look over there. Just look at your own spot and just, you know, I have such a problem with that.
Do you understand why you do that?
I mean, it has to all center around a control element.
There's something about this that just hit me, and something about this that I've held for a while. A lot of where this comes from is if somebody's going to make a mistake, the consequences for you are severe. You get punished for their mistakes. So where it comes from, in part, is that. There's something I wonder about. If I'm going to fail or succeed, if I'm going to be praised or beaten, then I want it to be based on my own merit.
Yes. And in fact, I was going to say that earlier. I'm actually much happier to accept criticism, constructive criticism, if I fucked up. If by proxy I get criticism because, you know, I don't know, I was part of the team, or if ever I'm part of a team, I want to be fully in control, because if something goes wrong, I will be fine with being like, yep, that's on me. If I'm not in control, then I have to kind of sit there, because that's what we learned that quickly in the cult as children. We just all kept our mouths shut. We all got beat, but we got beat for half the amount of time. So there's probably for sure a trauma response in there somewhere. But yeah, if I fuck up, I did it. It's my responsibility. So don't have to have feelings for anybody else in the sense of, oh shit, now that person's getting in trouble. And I'm just kind of sitting here like, I could have fixed it. I could have made it better.
It's really hard for you when someone else is suffering. And maybe it's, and I could have done something about it, or maybe it's, and there's nothing I can do about it. Either way, someone's suffering.
Yeah. For a majority of my life, there was nothing I could do about it. And so maybe I try extra hard. I hate watching people struggle. So I need to start, you know, weighing that, you know, overly hyper concerned for other people and other people's responsibilities. There's no reason for me to be like that, but I am.
No reason for me to continue to be like that.
Correct.
There is good reason for why I became like that.
That's fair. That's fair.
Is it? You do a good job of beating yourself up. We were talking about your cousin, what he was going through, and there was something so impactful. When you first walked into the hospital room, you just couldn't help it.
Yeah. It's rough.
And yeah, and seeing him that way, and it is so rough. And to have your mom be so dismissive of how you were feeling, and you, believe it or not, dismissive of how you were feeling.
Yeah.
It was very impactful, you know, but that's what you thought would be strong. I need to show strength for cousin.
Yes.
And you didn't get to have your emotional experience.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of feel like that's how I've dealt with any kind of real tragedy like that. Same with my dad. I sat with him for 3 weeks while he died, just, you know, trying to keep everybody around him cheery and, you know, keep the room clean and greet the hospice nurses when they came. And maybe I do that so I don't feel. I feel things very deeply, but I've gotten so good over the years at just, like, I'll feel that stabbing in my heart, but you won't see it on my face.
It's really important to have our own emotional experience of something. And you consciously and unconsciously, which you don't have control over yet, but we're building it, do that. You deny yourself so that you can project strength. And I think there's great strength in the vulnerability. There's great strength in having the emotion. I can tell you firsthand it is. And I've dealt with autoimmune issues for 15 years and psoriasis that would be cover my body and be very, very painful. There was a time when I would be in bed with my wife and she would just start bawling and crying. And I go, "What's wrong?" And she was crying because of my suffering.
Oh.
And you couldn't see mine at all. You would have no idea I was suffering. I was strong. And when I saw her crying, she was having the emotional expression that I was denying for myself.
Maybe that's why I cry at other things. Like I told you, I cry at really, you know, sad TV shows. Or like the other day, my daughter read a poem that she wrote and it made me tear up. Like things like that where you would not expect it to happen. Yeah.
The one where I brought up where the red fern grows.
Yes. Right?
And we talked about your doctor shows and being able to cry, you know, when there's a kid on Grey's Anatomy or something happens. It's something where when it's not your own experience, but you can identify with it and you identify the emotion, then you allow yourself to feel it. And what I was telling you back then was, instead of telling boyfriend, "Yeah, I'm crying, don't look at me," can you say, "Yes, I'm crying, it's triggering something"?
Yep.
And yeah, "Daughter, this book was really sad and you're crying, come on in and have a cry." And allowing the emotion to be there.
Yep.
That's what we're talking about. You are one of the most sensitive people I know. And you have such an incredible protective shell around that, which you've needed to have.
Yep.
We're not going to take you out of the shell and leave you exposed, but we're inviting you to come out of the shell and see what it's like.
Yeah. Yeah. At first I start thinking about it and it seems lovely and beautiful. And then comes back my rules, because they also apply to behavior. So if you open emotions, you know, the beautiful ones like the tenderness or the crying or the being sad for yourself or somebody else, those are wonderful. Then out come the rudeness and the, you know, the emotions that I really, really dislike. Those emotions, I'm sure, live in every single human being, right? There's a mixed bunch of feelings that came with that.
Why do the negative emotions have to come out when the not negative emotions also come out?
I don't know that they have to. I think it's my same concern with that whole opening the floodgate or the pendulum. You know, if I start crying when I feel like crying, well, maybe I tell somebody to fucking leave me alone when I feel like being left alone. I don't know.
Okay. Right. Let's find out. We can calibrate it. Let's find out. When I was taking vocal lessons a long time ago, I was such a timid singer. I was so worried about hitting the wrong notes or the right notes. So I sang very reserved and held back. Literally wasn't until I got on a mic in front of people that were coming to see me that I could actually belt out and sing. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You're nodding. You know the experience I'm talking about?
I know this experience. I mean, I'm sure I'm not as good of a vocal artist as you, but yes, I know that exact experience.
What I learned from that is when you make a mistake, make it loud. When I would try to sing and sing quietly, I couldn't hear, I couldn't correct, I didn't know. When I sang loud, hit a wrong note, let me correct, there, got it. And then you do it, and people are much more forgiving of that. Some of the greatest songs that I like, that I've heard, have singers whose voices crack in it. And I love the crack because it's real. It's emotion. Allow yourself to
feel.
Emote.
Yeah.
Feel. Yeah. And if it comes out, oops, a little too far over there, we'll course correct. You know, It's giving yourself permission to, and it might be cringeworthy. I mean, I saw you cringe for a second, like, ooh, no. Yeah. What if I just tell people to fuck off? What if I'm rude? What if it just like, wow, now I'm just telling people how I feel all the time. Okay, we'll calibrate that.
I've spent 40 years making myself this stoic person and hiding, you know, so there's, who knows what I'm actually, because dude, I can tell you some of the things I think in my head.
And we're talking about opening a floodgate, okay? And you're talking about, man, now I'm just going to start saying what I think all the time. Well, we're talking about expressing what you feel, which is different than saying what you think. Okay, but what you're feeling is the frustration.
Yeah.
So we're talking about getting in touch with that. If we have to risk offending some people or saying what we think sometimes, that's a risk we might need to take in order to find where that emotional expression lies and how we can then calibrate that. What we know is, when you don't do that at all, it stays internal.
Yep.
And to quote my friend Sarah, it's going to give me cancer and ulcers.
Yep.
How do you feel about that?
I feel like I'm going to think about it a lot. It's kind of like the meditating thing. I couldn't see that path before, and now I'm starting to see it. I'm sure it's just a lot of my own personal fears that are stopping me from seeing the way forward to this, you know, sort of maturely emotional person. I get, you know, data-wise, I've got this. Like, I know how to handle all that. But yeah, there's always a concern for me when something comes to the surface.
You're in therapy. You're talking to your therapist. We will calibrate this. We will experiment with this. And first step is doing it with me, which you've been doing. Second step might be doing it with my siblings or boyfriend. Okay. You know, we've got a few steps.
Yeah.
And we're going to try it. And expressing what you feel and saying what you think are two different things. We might, part of our work might be recognizing what are thoughts and what are feelings and building our emotional vocabulary.
If I do that, I just see all these other problems. Like the person's going to react to my frustration and then it's going to get worse and then they're going to shut down and then I'm going to feel guilty and that, you know. It spirals.
Right.
But that's why I'm going to think on it. Right. I'm going to think on it.
I'll say this. This might sound weird, but think on it and feel on it.
Okay.
Because it might be like, yes, data-wise, I got it. It makes sense. And you said it a second ago. Ooh, it makes me a little scared. Makes me a little nervous. Like, okay, I want to get in touch with that part too.
Okay. I've been very conscious over the last, I don't know, how long has it been? 8 months, 9 months that we've been working together on the anxiety part, right? All the stuff we've been talking about. This is now a new sort of exploration for me. So I like this. I like this for me. So yeah, gonna do it.
Yeah.
I'm gonna try it.
All right.
I'm not necessarily gonna do it.
You're gonna think on it and yes. feel on it.
Exactly. All right, Doug.
And we're back.
Hello, hello. Oh, Doug, I have thought and I'm
You are still fired up. We just went through a whole session and you're still just as fired up as you were.
I'm always fired up, ready to go. I'm just so passionate. Okay, in this session, and I'm going out of order here, but I think it's middle towards the end, whatever, but you bring up a personal story. I think you use it wisely. Maybe it's because it's out of context for me. I'm not sitting across from you in the room, but her talking about her emotional concerns and then you going straight into like a personal story. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie. It initially rubs me the wrong way. And I don't know if that's because I put myself in her shoes and I'm like, okay, if I were a client and my therapist just like went off on a personal story about their life, maybe I'm too judgy, but I would be like, why are you taking this away from me, man? Like, why are you making it about you right now? Yeah. But then like at the end, she gets it and she likes it. She likes when she hears your stories. And so I'm like, okay, context is important here, but I don't know. How do you feel about that, Doug? Is it me?
No, it's not you. It's, you know, you're right.
Thanks for the validation.
I do think you're right on with something that I do that. Sometimes in retrospect, looking back, I can say, no, that was strategic.
Yeah.
And maybe it's instinctual in the moment. I don't know. Mm. I'd love to say it is.
Yeah.
I will also think of it as, oh, right, I do that. I got to keep that in check. And I do that a lot. Like I do realize I need to keep certain things in check. There are many things I don't say. There's pretty much a pun for just about everything any person ever says to me. Mm-hmm. And I just hold it and I don't say it all the time. Right.
Okay. So you have a story that you could relate back to for pretty much everything.
Yeah, totally. There is something. Well, and maybe not everything all the time, but my brain is constantly thinking of, is there something relatable? Is there something I can highlight? Especially in session with a client. For Sarah in particular, she's somebody that has difficulty going to the emotional place, right? And this particular moment in this session, she's bringing something up with like maybe 10 minutes to go in a session.
Right.
So. Yeah. Again, in retrospect, I can't tell you in the moment because this is like a year ago that this happened. I'd love to believe this is true.
Right?
With 10 minutes to go, I probably realized I don't necessarily want to go, here's my opening for the emotional place with her. She's never really opened that door before. So I don't want to open it when we don't have time to really go there and really honor it.
Okay.
Not to mention when we pause.
Trash time.
Trash time. Trash talk. Hey, what did one bin say to the other bin?
Done. What, Doug?
How's it been? I don't know. I'm
getting... What the fuck? See, this is it. You just have something. It's like right on the tip of your prefrontal cortex all the time. It's amazing. They're gone.
They're gone?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's more about maybe the timing of it too. Like it's strategic in that way, well, or at least you're hoping.
So there's two... timings. Okay. One is the timing of the session.
Yeah,
with
10
minutes to go. I don't know that I want to open a door that I can't bring a client back from.
Sure. Yeah.
I learned about the arc of a session and how a session goes. And, you know, you small talk in the beginning, you get to some stuff, then you go deep, and then you have to bring them back up so they can leave.
It's the hardest part.
Back up, right? So that's why they call it the doorknob revelations, right? The
doorknob confessions or whatever,
Right as they're leaving, they'll drop something on you and you can't do anything with it.
Oh, yes.
Right. And it's frustrating as a therapist because you hear it and you're like, oh my gosh, I want to do something with that.
Yes, but right now.
We can't. I can't. I think ethically that there's a responsibility that we have to leave the client in decent shape, right? I mean, not to say they can't leave the room crying. I often, even just the last episode, I think we were like, okay, Sarah, let this percolate and see how it goes.
Yeah.
I love doing that and giving clients something to think about.
Definitely.
But raw emotion.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. And for a client who has said that Bruce Almighty drawer, like if I open something up, the floodgates are going to come out. That Acme like closet where you shoved everything in and if you open it, boom. So if this was maybe 10 minutes earlier, so we'd have 20 minutes in the session, partly timing-wise in the session, we didn't have enough time. Then there's timing-wise in terms of where the client is. Are they in a place where they can go here, go to the emotion, and we can do something productive with it? And I don't know, but the pace that Sarah and I have been going on is we're scratching at things. We're getting a little bit at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of the Bruce Almighty file popping way open, we're cracking it open. We're pulling a file out, maybe one at a time, maybe four or five at a time. Right.
That's a really good metaphor. I do really like that one, because another question I have for you is like, what do you do when a client is scared of opening the floodgates in quotes? Right. Because I get that all the time. I think a lot of our more intellectually minded, scientifically minded, logical clients, they're just so scared of, well, scared of change. Right. Everyone is.
Right.
And
right.
also
totally.
Scared of just like, oh, God, but if I cry about my actual emotional experience, like, then what? Like, I'm going to be a mess.
Right.
And
right.
I think you make a really good distinction. It's more about feeling the feelings. You don't necessarily have to act on them. I think that's what people are actually scared of. It's like, well, if I feel my feelings, I'm going to like scream and punch everybody. And it's like, no, you're not.
Right. Right.
Most of you are not going to do that, actually.
Right. At most, right?
Most,
and,
I say,
and not,
yeah.
Maybe
most.
Not literally, but there right, are right. there are clients I've worked with where we will open something up.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can catch that it's going to be really transformational for them or might be like a floodgate type of thing, I might even say, hey, if you're walking around this week and pretty raw, like make sure you journal it, you know, or text me or email me, you know, because some stuff we stirred up a lot and some things might come up for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Let them come up. Just acknowledge them.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to ask you. You do go there. And my question for you was like, okay, but what's the like scientific, like what's the more clinical reasoning or explanation to give a client when they're scared of opening the floodgates? Because like the Bruce Almighty drawers and the file cabinets and the whipping out the suitcase and like refolding some things, right? Like all of those analogies totally click and make sense. And they don't maybe come as naturally to me right now. And I would rather, because I'm more of a literal person, I guess.
Get the psychology of it.
Get the psychology
what
of it. Yeah, what does it mean? And so I'm glad you said like, well, sometimes it does come down to just whipping out a tool from the toolbox, like using the journaling, using the punching bag or whatever, and just getting that hit of catharsis in that moment just to let it out somewhere that's safe and not going to hurt anybody or yourself. So glad that you cleared that up.
Absolutely. Especially when clients aren't used to expressing. When we're scratching at something and I can tell that they have repressed and suppressed what their actual emotional experience is, and it's in there, and we start opening, not the floodgates, but we're starting to, maybe we've put the right combination in the lock, but we haven't popped the lock open and taken it off the door.
Another freaking metaphor.
I can't help
it. It's just, I'm jealous.
And I will say to them, wow, I feel like I wish, you know, you could just go out to the beach or go up a mountain and just have this primal scream. You know, I wonder if the scream would just be a primal, you know, or if it would actually be like a statement. And I wonder what that statement would be. I mean, I can't really put you there, but I'd love to see that happen.
That's cool.
Just putting it in their heads and giving them permission to let it out, to let it out, even if it's raw emotion. They don't have to journal and write it coherently write something
not.
That makes sense or write some free form flow of here, dear diary, here's what I feel today. It might just be, I was walking around going, fuck. Okay.
And that's often what it looks like.
And I want them to be able to give themselves permission to do that. That's why I was saying to Sarah, oh, it's anger. I wanted to name it and go scream into a pillow, punch that, like get that raw emotion out.
Right.
It's sort of like, here comes another one. Like
warning.
Warning. When you've had food poisoning or eaten something bad and you know you're going to throw up, but you don't want to throw up. Some people are just like, let me just throw up and get it over with. Others are like, no, I don't want to throw up. I have a phobia. You know,
me.
I know.
That me.
That's why I'm using this one.
Perfect.
And you know, once you do, you're going to feel raw. You're going to be a little shaky and you will probably feel better,
so much better
and worse at the same time. That's kind of what this is.
It's true. You got to take the good with the bad.
There it is.
Okay. Thanks for that. I'm not going chronologically today, but you do tell her pretty directly, like, you are one of the most sensitive people I know. And I know that you're saying that in a positive way, right? Like, despite you not feeling your feelings all the time, right? Like, you're actually, Sarah, one of the most sensitive people I know, which to me, I hear that and I'm like, oh, that's so sweet. And she laughs a little bit. And I'm wondering why you didn't really like hit that, because I would have been so tempted to be like, oh, I heard a little chuckle there. Like, what does that mean to you? What does sensitivity mean to you? Because obviously there's a fear of being sensitive or like a scoffing, like a self-judgment that she has about her sensitivity. Maybe. I don't know.
Is that obvious?
Maybe it's not. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, like prematurely.
Well, how would you know?
So I guess you have to ask her about it. But you don't. That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm wondering why you don't hit that kind of like, hey, I heard a lot. No, I want, but we're back to my question though, because I'm wondering why you didn't ask her about that laugh. Or like, do you think you get to it later and that's why it doesn't really matter?
I know I get to it later. Okay. I log that as, oh, okay, that's a defense mechanism.
Of course.
And she's done that several times. This isn't the first time she's done that. I sometimes will make a face.
And you probably did.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I sometimes will pin it. Mm-hmm. I will often not let a client dismiss something, as you've heard me do with Sarah recently.
Yeah.
And it's about not challenging them every time they do it. It's about marking it so that when you do, you can go, yeah, you kind of do that as a defense. Mm-hmm. And I'll often say it that way. You do it as a defense. It's a protective mechanism, which comes up a lot in what we've been talking about with her.
And the trauma response and all of that. And it's funny because in previous sessions, the trauma response thing and just trauma in general, like relating things back to her trauma has been kind of a sticky point for her. It's been a little difficult. And I think she's finally in a place where she's just saying it matter-of-factly, like, oh yeah, that's probably a trauma response. Like, yeah, that is my protective mechanism. Okay.
Right. And I don't want to take it away from her right now.
Yeah.
That's not safe. That's, here you go. Now I feel like I've got to preface every time I use a metaphor or analogy.
Oh no. See, that's me. I'm a judgy asshole.
Right? I wouldn't say that. I don't think I really don't think you're judgy. You're just an asshole.
Thanks, Doug. That makes me feel so much better.
It's the turtle in the shell, right?
Yeah. Like, I've used that one before.
See, there you go. Right? You can't just take the turtle out of its shell and expect it to feel safe and fine. You're taking it out of its home, out of its protective shell. Mm-hmm. So with her, this session to me is all about allowing the emotional experience. I don't necessarily want to go after her raw and vulnerable and pull her out of her shell. I want her to come out when she feels safe coming out.
Yeah.
I will do things that point to it, but I'm not going to go right for it every time.
Yeah, there is an art to kind of picking and choosing when to really call out the affects that change in session, in the moment, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, functional analytics, like whatever, you know, those clinically relevant behaviors, like her scoffing at sensitivity might technically be like one of those clinically relevant behaviors that we would call out. But you're right, there's more to it in this context, which is also important, like the timing of it, where is she at? The turtle in the shell, right?
And in this session, she's talking about things like being valued versus being essential.
Yeah.
And then being essential is being seen as I matter.
Yes, that hit so well for her. I mean, that hit her right where it needed to.
And a big part of why that hit is she did not have that experience growing up in the cult at all. Mm-mm. And I'm highlighting for her a lot of what you didn't have growing up, you can have now through your kids. That's why I bring up kids a lot, because it's reparenting herself. She was saying, I need to do things great. We don't get C's in this family.
Right. Oh my gosh. I did not get that one at first because I was like, did Sarah really say that? We don't get C's in this house? Because, you know, I'm maybe closer in age or just closer mentally to like working with teens, right? And I see the harm of like, oh God, saying that to a teenager. Like that freaks me out. Like we don't get C's in this house. It's so like, you know, punitive, like, oh God, it sounds so scary, right? But I'm thinking about it now in terms of Sarah, and I'm like, oh yeah, it makes sense. Of course we don't get C's in this house, because if we get a C, we're gonna get beaten or something. Right. Like it's totally back to little Sarah.
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's why, again, I want to point it out without diving into it too deep
and like attacking it,
right? That wouldn't serve anything. So I think that idea that she'll come to, and she did, she does in this session, she says, I need to find places where I can relax a bit.
Yeah.
I need to take that down a notch. That's when, to answer one of your earlier questions, I don't know if it was today or weeks ago, but whatever, we get there eventually.
It was a question.
It's kind of meta for how I do therapy. Like we get there eventually.
Let's go full circle. Yeah.
Right? Well, we did talk about this today, like bringing it back to the clinical. Right? So I do say to her, well, that's the trauma response.
Right. That's true. You mix it in there for sure.
We understand that. And then I come in and bring in something from her frames of reference, not mine and not my stories. I want her to pull something. And I do it very strategically, because I brought up something where she did get very emotional. And that was talking about her cousin that passed.
Yeah.
So bringing that up and talking about that again.
Yeah.
Something really cool happened where she related that to talking about her dad.
When he was on his deathbed, right? And she had to like make everyone feel okay about it and basically do the whole keep calm, Sarah can handle it, right? Yeah.
Literally, she has that on a t-shirt.
Right, yeah. Right? Oh, I can't wait to get to that stuff.
Right. But that's exactly it because, you know, and this whole session, again, allowing the emotional experience.
Yeah.
What are we talking about? I related something about her cousin and how that was. She related that to her dad and how she couldn't have her emotional experience because she didn't give herself permission.
Yeah.
Because she couldn't. Because of how she was growing up.
Yeah.
So I will be the one projecting here, everything's cheery and everything's good. And I'm going to be like nice with the hospice nurses and I'm going to keep it this way. And she even recognized like, so I don't feel.
Yeah.
I don't feel things deeply. I've gotten so good at not doing this.
Going
so
robot.
You won't ever see it on my face. Yeah. I go to the robot.
At one point you ask her, how do you feel about that? And she answers the most Sarah answer ever. I feel like I'm going to think about it a lot. And it was like my favorite thing because I was like, oh, my, that's it right there. That is such a Sarah answer, such a Sarah response. Right. And I like, though, that you know, you took it for what it was right there in the moment, but then you came back to it and you did call her out on it a little bit, like towards the end of the session, you know, think about it for sure and feel it too.
Right.
See what it feels like to actually like do both.
She's just doing this for arguably the first time ever in her life.
Yeah. Wow.
And part of what we're doing, and I said, like, we're in therapy. You're talking to your therapist. Mm-hmm. We're going to work on this. We're going to calibrate how this is to do these things. And that's okay. It's why I said to her, it's like meditating.
Yeah. Right?
Because early on, I told her, look, I'm not going to tell you to meditate. She's like, oh, thank God. Right.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to tell her to have an emotional experience right now everywhere she goes all the time. Mm-hmm. That's the turtle out of the shell. Can't do that. That's not safe. Even right now for her, that's not safe. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's just kind of experiment with it. Let's just do like a little bit with it. That's why I said the first step is you do it here with me.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
literally when we talk about therapy being a safe space. Mm-hmm. That's what this is.
Yeah.
Try this out with me. It's safe here.
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe you can do it with siblings or with boyfriend. And
okay,
we've got a few steps to go. Mm-hmm. Let's try it out.
It's perfect. I think that's the thing that's missing a lot of the times in therapy, maybe, is that context of where's the client at? Like, that's what truly I think Carl Rogers meant by like meeting the client where they're at, right?
Exactly.
Is like, where are they? Can they even access their emotional experience? You can't just tell a client, hey, let's feel our feelings.
Right.
Which we get to a lot with Sarah because it's like the crux of the thing, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not that simple. It's really not. Like, what does it even look like for them?
Yeah. And what I think is amazing is right at the end of this session, she says, you know, very consciously over the last 8 or 9 months that we've been working together, there's the anxiety stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And now there's this new exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
Great. And she can think on it and feel on it. It's all new. She's exploring this.
Yeah.
And
it's
how
a yes and.
Absolutely.
It's both.
I'm often very amazed and impressed with how much she is doing the work herself. And you'll hear that her next session to me is all about like the work that she's been doing outside of our sessions on herself week to week.
It's so good.
Ugh, I love it.
Yeah.
And as a therapist, that's...
I know. It's so fulfilling to see a client really show up for themselves and just try and do.
Right.
I know you would say it's not trying, they're doing.
Right.
And you're right. Like she's doing it.
Yeah.
And it's hard and she's doing it anyway.
Right.
When they're really in it and they're like working and you can tell that it is working, like what you're doing is working.
Right.
Of course, it's positive reinforcement classic.
Sure.
Like it's like, oh, cool. This is inspiring and it's fulfilling.
And it's okay that it's not necessarily every week. Some weeks might just be like, here's the crap that went down this week.
Yeah.
I need to talk about this.
Yeah. Vent session.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool.
Do we have time for the, should we even bother with the cockpit pilot metaphor story? Or, well, going back to like in the beginning, right? My question was like, how do you just whip out metaphors and stories all the time? Do you think it's problematic sometimes that you take them out of their feelings and just whip out the story, right? Or the metaphor? Like, is that, ooh, I don't know how I feel about that, right? And part of that is because I maybe respond like Sarah does to certain metaphors and stories, like this one in particular, when you're talking about, obviously, we're talking in general about the theme of control, right? But we're talking about like the cockpit pilot metaphor. I'm like Sarah, where I will always find a loophole or like a reason why the metaphor isn't perfectly accurate, right?
Right. Yep. Yep.
And I get it. I get her when she was kind of arguing and challenging you on it. I was like, yep, I would have done the same exact thing as a client. And I just think, like, okay, if you have to change the whole thing, right? And just because you do say, like, well, let's just say you did know about navigation, right? Because she's like, well, I wouldn't do that because I'm not a pilot. I don't know navigation. So I'm like, okay, well, what's the point then if we have to really change this and morph this metaphor to make it work for this story, right? Like, is it still meaningful? Is it still having the impact that you want it to have?
Is it?
Are you throwing the question back on me? I think eventually it does. She says, it would really calm me if I was a pilot. Like, if I got to tell them what to do as a passenger,
right?
Oh, that would really relax me. And right. It's like, oh, okay. So we're making the connection here that, oh, control equals relaxation for her. Ah, right. Okay. Right. So it does land in a way. But at first, I was like, was that a flop of a metaphor? Did I catch Doug in a flop?
No. For starters, you got to know that airplane metaphors will always land.
No! Oh my God. This is so frustrating. I quit.
Here's the thing, though. What I do when I bring out a metaphor or analogy is I know what it is I'm trying to highlight.
Okay. You do and it with intention.
Absolutely. Yeah. I do. Every story, every analogy, every metaphor is to highlight something for them that I see going on for them that I want them to see from a not super subjective place. Because in the same way that you just said, oh, God, well, that would relax me. If we put her in an actual stressful situation, she might not feel relaxed until she actually gets to experience the thing that would relax her.
Which is exerting some form of control, but you don't always have control. So that's kind of the point, right?
Which is ultimately the point. I'm driving home kind of one of our mantras is relax, nothing's under control.
And anxiety.
We can't do that yet. So I'm looking at, well, what's relaxation? Relaxation is control.
Right.
And even if you're not flying the plane, you want to just check in and make sure because you're scared.
Yeah. You got to do what feels good to you. And just because it feels good doesn't mean it's actually effective in helping you. It just means it's, you know, serving the purpose it did years ago.
Right. So again, me bringing in that analogy is just highlighting some of these emotions that she's not that great at expressing yet, but she's absolutely feeling them. So I want to give her an opportunity to feel or recognize those feelings without walking through the actual thing. It's not about did the analogy land or not land. I know that she takes to them well. She learns from them well. Drew is very similar.
Yes.
Like on the podcast, you're hearing two clients that actually really like this metaphor and analogy.
Yeah. So
I have some clients that don't. Right?
Ah, interesting. So I'd love to hear those sessions.
Every client's going to be different. Every time I'm working with somebody, it's slightly different. Yeah. Not just because I'm using different analogies. I use different ones with Sarah than I do with Drew. Some I use the same. Yeah. Some stories, I've told the same stories. Some clients don't know any of my stories and don't know anything about me because it's not relevant to their work.
You read the room.
You read the room.
What is being a therapist if not reading the room? What are you doing? You were coming in hot with a joke. Well, what else is there to say?
You know what does land?
What, Doug?
I don't know, but stick around. Next week, we'll be back. And we'll see, it's so unfulfilling. You need the end of it, don't you?
Yeah, you're right. I actually need the punchline.
Right? You want the punchline.
Oh,
you need people like me on the line.
Oh, no. He's therapy ninjing me on the podcast.
We'll come back next week and we will therapy ninja.
Therapy ninja.
Yeah, love it. Love it. Term. We will see you next week.
Alrighty. See you then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.